Welcome to The Afterglow. The Afterglow podcast gives women, we're talking to you, the permission and tools to live life according to your own rules.
Yes, this is a platform to educate and empower women identifying humans through intriguing conversations with courageous Canadian women who are breaking down limiting beliefs and outdated rules. These women have done it, are doing it, or can provide tools for you to do the same.
We are Julie Watson
and Liz Doyle-Hermer.
And we started Afterglow, our yoga studio, after years of staying home to raise kids. Now, as podcasters, we want to help others do the same. Step into your own power. It's time to shake things up and get real about who you are and what you want.
The Afterglow is your next act. It's what came after you did what you were told and instead decided to do what was in your heart. It's how you have reinvented yourself. It's your vision for the next 40 to 50 years. It's when you took your power back.
This episode is sponsored by the Richards Group, and we know you're going to love it.
Welcome to The Afterglow. We're so honored to have had an Olympic athlete on our show as we kick off the 2021 Summer Olympics. Perdita Felician is a two-time Olympian, having competed in the 100-meter hurdles at Sydney in the 2000 Games, as well as Athens in the 2004 Games. She's a national 10-time champion in the 100-meter hurdles. She's had several notable accomplishments internationally as well. She won gold at the 2003 IAAF World Championships, becoming the first Canadian female athlete to ever reach the podium at the IAAF Worlds. She would add a silver medal at the 2007 IAAF World Championships. And in 2004, Perdita won the world indoor title in the 60-meter hurdles. She would also take silver in that event at the 2010 World Indoor Championships. Perdita set the Canadian record in the 100-meter hurdles in June 2004, running 12.46 seconds in Oregon. A favorite to win Olympic gold at Athens in 2004, Perdita clipped the first hurdle in the final. We remember watching that race and did not finish. She was then unable to compete at Beijing 2008 due to a left foot injury. We talked to Perdita about recovering from those events and the resilience she developed in recovering from them. And we also spoke to her about the inspiration behind her amazing new book, My Mother's Daughter, A Memoir of Struggle and Triumph. We talked to her about the impact her mother has had on her life and her own personal drive to excellence, whether it's in the athletic space or just the personal life space. And we also spoke to her about finding her own voice at 40 and speaking up. We really loved this episode of The Afterglow with Perdita Felician, and we think you will too.
Okay, well, welcome to The Afterglow. We're so excited to have you because I can remember like where I was in 2004. I was like almost ready to deliver my second child. And so this is like, it's such an honor to have you. You're like this superhero in our minds. And so welcome. Welcome to The Afterglow.
Yeah, glad to have it. Awesome name too. I love the name.
Well, we want to hear about your afterglow, but we'll get there at the end. To start, we'd love to start with your beginning. And really, I suppose it's your mother's beginning, right? You just wrote a beautiful book, a memoir, My Mother's Daughter, about your mother's influence on you. And so tell us about those first five chapters. You don't have to tell us everything, but just tell us about your mother and the role she's played in your life, her impact on you.
Yeah, so My Mother's Daughter really is a love letter to my mother. And I think, you know, a love letter to all mothers and that bond that, you know, mothers and daughters have. And really, I think people are like, oh, Perdita Felician has written a book. It has to be about the Olympics. And, you know, I have to say, you have to wait till halfway through the book before you get any sports, right? Or at least to the Olympic parts. But the book starts with my mother's story. And essentially my mother, you know, is a teen mother. I'm not born, I'm not around, but she's had dropped out of school as a probably 11 or 12 year old. And now she's a late teenager and she is selling on the beach. That's her job. And she sees an opportunity one day. She sees a man sitting down on beach property hotel property rather, because she's on the beach, but you're not allowed as a beach vendor to trespass onto, you know, hotel property. You know, you'll get in trouble for that. So she sees a man sitting down on the pool deck with a baby. She looks around to make sure there are no guards around. And then she darts over to him and says, "Hey, do you need a babysitter?" Basically. And, you know, this is the late 70s. And for some reason, they agree. And my mother starts babysitting this 3-month-old baby. And that relationship with this family, the Baxters, brings her to Canada. But when she comes
So this was in St. Lucia.
In St. Lucia. Okay. Yeah, her tiny island of St. Lucia. That's right. So while she's there, she has to leave her whole family behind, including her kids. And she comes to Canada and starts a life here. And really, that's where the story really picks up, because you see my mother trying to figure it out here, you know, without her kids. She has me in Canada as she's trying to build her life. I'm not planned. That just throws, you know, another big wrench into her plans. And, you know, the difficult thing about starting this book is I had to confront the day that my mother had to decide whether or not, as she's pregnant with me, to keep me. And that was a very, very hard thing to kind of go back and dive into with her. But I had to give you that story so that you could see, you know, who I'd become and what all of it meant to me as an athlete.
There's so much like raw and realness and authenticity. And I know that your mother believes in that whole authenticity and being honest and sharing her experiences. And so she shared so many stories. And I know that, you know, you have your story, she has her story, but let's just tell a little bit of the story about the day that she went into labor. I know that that's a big story and you probably have repeated it a million times, but it's so powerful and you've painted it so well in the book.
Yeah. So this is, she's decided to keep me, like I said, she's a domestic worker. Her other children are in St. Lucia. So she's working in the, she's living in the basement of an elderly couple and the Harrys, and she's pregnant with me. And, but she had been working up until she went to labor on this particular day. And they didn't give her any time off. She knocks on their door, you know, to kind of say, "Hey, you know, Mrs. Harry," to her employer, "you know, I'm gone into labor, you know, can someone help me? Can someone drive me to the hospital?" Well, she finds it, Abigail finds it too inconvenient to kind of get up. And I came early, right? I came, you know, a few weeks early. So it was always like, almost like a surprise to her. She doesn't get up. So my mother goes back downstairs. She calls really the only lifeline that she has at that time. You know, my mother's a 24, 25 year old. And she calls a woman named Joyce, who tells her, and the reason she has Joyce is because Joyce is a woman from Barbados who used to work for this family. Mm. So she understands that my mother is probably in very difficult situation with them. So she kind of called when my mom first started years before to just kind of be a help. So my mom calls this only person that she can help. And she says, "Kathy, you go and get yourself ready, wash yourself up, call a taxi." Mom doesn't really know how she's going to pay for the taxi, but she's called a taxi. So as mom is just in labor and getting her stuff together, and, you know, I'm coming, I'm on my way. Of course, she doesn't know it's me, but I'm on my way. And she hears some cautious footsteps coming down to the basement. It's Abigail Harry, her employer, who suddenly decides, you know what, probably need to take care of this woman and take her to the hospital. But before she can even take my mother to the hospital, because she knows my mother will be gone for at least a week. Times are very different. You can stay in the hospital for a while, right? Back in the 80s. And she asked my mother to make them food. And specifically the request is 10 tuna sandwiches that my mother has to cut up in a particular way, take off their crust and freeze them. So this couple has food and sustenance for the next few days, all while my mother is in active labor and clearly in pain. Mm. So that is what, you know, I got ushered into the world through.
Oh my God. So, you know, so angering, right? That situation is angering, that your mother had to live through that. And then also, you know, your mom, because Julie and I, we listened to quite a few interviews, we heard that your mom came back. There was no rest after that either, right away, just get back on your feet, start to work again. And so what, you know, what do you think was baked into your mother to give her that resilience to just overcome that situation, right? Where did she get that resilience and strength from?
You know, it's so interesting talking to, you know, my girlfriends have read the book and they know my mother, of course, they've known me for years. I've been friends with these women. And as well as they know my mother, that is the question that really comes up. Like, Why does she keep going? Why? And for my mother, it wasn't necessarily that she was accepting these things, right? Like, she knew they weren't okay. But I think she also knew that if I can just endure, if I can just make it through this, like, this storm one day will run out of rain and my life will be different. The life of my kids will be different. And I think what perplexes even me as the woman that I am today, and even my friends when we sometimes talk about the book, is like, man, I would have cursed out that woman. I would have gotten in that taxi, had my kid, and gotten on a plane to St. Lucia, right? And I think, you know, I think it's easier for us to say as the women that we are now, you know, privileged in a completely different, you know, circumstances. But I think for my mother, it was always, one, it's just really who she is. And I think at times, even as I was writing the book, the editors are like, really? This is really how she faced this? I'm like, yeah, that's my mother. Like, people are like, she's still friends with Bruce. She's still friends with your dad. I'm like, yeah, like, that's the case. She was there this week, like literally there this week to make sure he had what he needed and he was okay. You know, drove over there with her husband. That is my mother's heart. So where does it come from? I truly believe it comes from my grandmother, who I didn't know super well, but by, you know, researching the book and talking to people, they were just really kind and soft-hearted. And I do honestly, and I will say this, and I truly believe in like blessings and the fact that we can pass these things on. If it wasn't for the goodness of my grandmother, if it wasn't for the goodness of my mother, I know for a fact the life that I have now, the abundance that I have now, right? All these great things that I live and my daughter who's 2 years old, Nova, lives, really is because of them, right? I truly believe we've inherited their blessings. We've, you know, inherited kind of a lot of that greatness, and they've given it to us. Had my mom been a wicked woman, an unkind woman, I don't know that our life would be, you know, the way it is now. Yeah, she had to go through some really high hurdles for us to get to this point, but she never lost sight of who she was, and she never lost sight of what she wanted for herself and for her kids.
I love that idea or that visual of this storm is going to run out of rain. Like, I love that. That's just such an amazing way to look at life. And, you know, you speak about how things get passed down, and along with the blessings that get passed down, the traumas get passed down as well, right? And there's, a lot out there right now that talks about intergenerational trauma, talks about how the traumas are passed down, particularly in the BIPOC community, but also with specific things that your mother experienced. I mean, she experienced domestic violence. She experienced, you know, intimate partner violence, and she was one of the brave few that got out and, you know, went into the Denise house that I'm hoping we'll speak about a little bit later. But, you know, her experience is one thing, but then you also have your experience of the trauma, the intergenerational trauma, but then also the impact of what you went through watching your mom, as well as your own experience in the, you know, environment of domestic violence and having to leave that. So how did you overcome that? How did you get through that time for yourself and you know, are not, you know, now in this position of feeling scarred and traumatized?
Yeah, I remember the first time I ever spoke about this was in 2017, like the being a child witness of domestic violence. Before that, you can look, you know, I was an athlete for more than a decade, you know, well-known. You'll never find an article or sound clip of me ever discussing my childhood in this way at all. Because there was such a sense of just a secret, right? That secret. And I think those in our circle knew. I think for me, I ignored it for most of my life. That's the truth. I ignored it for most of my life. I think it was easy to ignore in a way because my mother still was so forgiving to our father that he was just always around in some way. Even if they weren't romantically linked and they weren't together, he was still my father. And my mother made sure that we knew that. And we still gave him that level of respect, right? It wasn't until I was probably, and I talk about it in the book, I was probably around 27, that I truly awoke to what my childhood was like and what my dad had done to my mother. And it was like, whoa. And that's when I completely turned on him. I completely rebelled. And my mother would say to me, he's still your dad. He's still your dad. And that would vex me. That would vex my spirit, because like, how could you forget that he made you and I and my sister suffer because he just wanted to control us? He would turn off the water and he would turn off the electricity into the house and leave for work. And we'd have nothing. We'd be in pitch darkness. How could you forget that? And I think that it's her ability to forgive that at times I love about my mother, but I'll be honest, frustrated me at times, because it's like, you can't let people get away with these things. You can't, you know, just have people, you know, not call them to task and to reckoning. And I do feel like this book, I believe my dad has not read it, right? I know it's probably hard for him to face at times. You know, I hear things through my siblings, like, you know, dad's asking how your book's doing and stuff like that. And I think this is the first true reckoning that all of us in my family have had about our childhood. I think what has helped me, honestly, is my mother's strength, right? Like, she's never defined herself by this. And we, as a result, don't. We don't feel like we are a product of that environment. Like, we've redefined who we are, although that will always be in us, right? I also know that it's why I tried and I was so devoted to not having a house like that as an adult. Mm-hmm. I will have a caring partner. I will have a father for my child that is present and is there. And I have that now. But it's because of what I saw, I was determined not to repeat that. And that trauma that you talked about being passed on, I was going to be the end. I was going to be the end of this curse. And it was going to stop here. And it has.
It certainly has. I'm curious about, you know, the process of writing, and you spoke about having this incredible bond with your mother, and it's obvious, right? In every interview we watch, the love between you two. And I think in our future focused culture, we're always looking ahead. You were an athlete. You're always training for some future date, 2, 3, 4 years out. And this process of looking back at everything, which is in reality, it's an indigenous way of being too. They always, you know, recognize the ancestors that have come before them. And I'm wondering what has changed in you and in your relationship with your mother through that process of looking back behind you. What has changed in you and your relationship?
That's a really striking question. No one's asked me that before in that way. And let me reflect. Let me soul search for that. I think one, the deep sense of gratitude that I have for her struggle and her strife. What would happen in some of these interviews is my mother would cry. And it brought me back to being 5 and 6 and 9 and 12 and mom is crying. This time in the interview, she's crying because she's reliving it. And I did not realize how close to the surface all of this is for my mother as a woman and as a wife. And, you know, as an individual, as I was writing and researching the book, though, right, a lot of it was, I want the facts to be true. I want to make sure I'm getting this right. So I never was able to really truly go there as the daughter, if that makes sense. I was in there as the reporter, the researcher, the person that wants to make sure the story is truly authentic. And, you know, there were blanks that I couldn't fill in and I had to let them go. And now it's done. The book is out there. And I think I am now, wow, I can become the daughter because the work is done. Mm-hmm. And I'm connecting with her in a way I don't think we've connected before in a really long time. Mm-hmm. And now I'm a mother too, right? So the book is out and I'm a mother. I have a 2-year-old. I put myself more truly in her shoes. What would it mean for my Nova in the middle of the night to have her father put me out? And my child is going to the front lawn and picking up my perfume and my necklaces and my heels. What that would feel like as a woman to experience that, to be so ashamed that my husband has turned off the water and we live in a first world country. We have no water, no running water, no toilet to flush, nothing to drink. And I have to ask my child, put a tub of ice cream, a plastic tub of walnut ice cream, maple walnut in her hands, and ask her to go across the street to her best friend's house and ask for a pint of water. The amount of shame she would carry, like I was the cover for her shame. And so I think to answer your question, you know, for the first time and unpacking it right now is, I feel a deeper sense of wanting to protect my mother, a deeper sense of gratitude for her. Yes, for giving me life and giving birth to me and all those things. But this woman, all she had to do was make one decision and be like, F all of this. I'm gone. I'm out. And take me and her and my sister and go back to St. Lucia. And our life would have been very different, right? Like this Olympic experience, you know, even potentially even writing this book and being a broadcaster and all these titles that I'm so proud of, right? First person in my family, in the lineage of any woman in my family to have a university degree. None of that would have been possible without her sacrifices. And the sacrifices, you know, if you unpack what they really are for my mother, it's her putting her pride aside. It's her sacrificing her identity and who she is for the greater good of her children and hopefully her later self.
You're making me want to know my own mother's story better, right? That's what I'm sure Julie's feeling the same way. She's close with her mother, but there's always more we can learn about our own mothers, right? What they've been through, stuff we don't know. And that's what you're doing for me right now. I want to know, you know my own mother better.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you feel that way, because I do think at times as we grow up, we see our parents maybe in one place as mom, but mom as your mom is different than the woman that she is. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Different. And to learn who she is as a woman, I think that is a gift. That is a gift to have. And then even to have that to pass on, you know, to take account of that. I think that's a beautiful thing as daughters to be able to do. So I'm glad you've said that.
Yeah, that is very powerful. And you know, it's reminding me of the honesty and authenticity that your mother had and that she shared with you, and that you saw her crying and you saw her tears. And so you're reminded of that. And that takes me to, you know, the reason that you ran, that you were doing your hurdles, that you worked so hard is to make your mom happy and to stop the tears. And so, you know, that's just such a beautiful thing. And so the connection was there so early on for you, you know, and the evolution of your relationship seems like it's a beautiful thing. And so tell us about that. Tell us about, you know, how you first got started in hurdles, but also how your mom kind of carried you through along the way.
Oh, she was a nag. That's how you put it. She was my mother nagged me into hurdles. Let me tell you. So I got into them by chance. I'm the only person in my family that's really an athlete. So people always wonder, like, did your mom do this? Like, who did this? And the answer is not really. I was in grade 3 and was doing Canada Fitness. And my teacher, my gym teacher, Mrs. Arthur, noticed my ability and really just celebrated it. And then in grade 4, she made me go out for the team. And so that's how I found sport. I remember I came home one day and I had made the track team and my mother was vacuuming and I ran in. I was so excited. And I was like, mom, I made it for the team. And bursting through the door, she stopped the vacuum and she had no, I didn't know this, but she's describing this to me. She had no clue what the track team was. She saw how my eyes dazzled and how excited I was that she played along. She's like, honey, that's amazing. That's great. And then she went back to vacuuming. Had no idea this world of sport and physical exercise and even the, you know, the potential for what it would mean, this vehicle of like upward mobility. My mother had no idea. And it wasn't until I kept winning for years, grade 4 and grade 5 and grade 6, that finally my father said, like, Padita's actually good. And then she's like, well, let me go see for myself. And then she went to the Oshawa Civic, saw me beat everybody's butt. And I was like, oh, and then she was hooked because she was the loudest in the stadium, cheering on. I mean, she had lost her mind. And I think that is really where I realized, and I would always, my manners made my mother happy. My good grades made my mother happy. But suddenly I'm introduced to this new medium, this sport thing that made her even more happy. Mm-hmm. You know, when I would get a good grade, my mom was happy. Let me win a race. Kathy, oh boy, she was crunk, right? So I think really when she saw me, so I raced all through elementary school, but then I lost a really big meet in grade 8 to a girl named Shelly Ann Brown. Now, if you don't know the name Shelly Ann Brown, you need to know it because she was like the baddest sprinter. She moved to our region, so she was new that year. I had never raced her and I won all the way up until grade 8. Until that year, she moved into our district and she beat me. Now, you know, you might not know this, but she went on to be like an Olympian. She won a silver medal in the Olympics in bobsleigh for Canada. I mean, like, that's the pedigree I was up against, okay? Yeah.
And so, grade 8, wow, that's tough.
Exactly. I'm still bitter though, Shelly Ann, if you're listening to this.
Yeah, you were robbed.
I kicked my butt. But then I quit. And when I quit for 2 years, my mother really nagged me. And she uses the word, I encouraged you, honey. I'm like, no, you nagged me. to keep trying out for sport. And I did not want to do it for 2 years. And the reason I didn't want to do it for 2 years is because I got beat and I was embarrassed. But then I will say this, I was so determined to just, you know, still be great, go to university, get a great job and do well. Sport was never for me an avenue or a vehicle that I thought I didn't know there was more. And had it not been really for her saying to me, like, God gave you a gift and you should see it through. Mm-hmm. That I wouldn't have stopped to go back to sport because I'm a very stubborn person. I'm very determined. So when my mind was made up that I'm good and done, I was done. And part of me cringes every time I think about what that headstrong 16 and 17 year old, how I would have, you know, written my life very differently. There's no doubt I would have been successful, but there's such a unique experience to being the best in the world, seeing what you can do in a realm that most people really will never get to see. You know, I was at the top of the pyramid of sport, and that really was because of my mother. So if you go back to the beginning of our conversation, the story about my mother selling on the beach and doing it, and the fact that she wanted more for her kids, I literally was living out loud a dream that she had. She didn't know what that dream looked like, right? She didn't have all the colors to paint this picture, but suddenly she has her child living this dream. And I think when I look back at my career, I have to be thankful to my mother, you know, beyond just lip service saying, thank you, mom. No, like this woman literally dragged me to every start line, even if it wasn't literally, it was very figuratively that she got me there and just had me going.
It's that that thing about our life being a series of sliding doors, right? You know, and every different opportunity or choice that you make is really what takes you. And your mom had that in many different times with, you know, going on the beach and doing that and then deciding to have you or not and, you know, leaving and going into a safe house. And then you're doing that along the way as well. So I think that that's it just shows you how and where life can take you, right?
And that persistence as well that she had, right? To keep nagging you for 2 years. Like I know I've got teenagers, right? So a couple of times I might bring it up and then I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. I tried.
I tried. 2 years.
That's amazing. We had read that you did not like hurdles at first. Is that true?
Oh, that is a fact. I hated the event. Like, what is there to like about like running at these like plastic and wooden and metal barriers, 100% effort and like jumping 10 times? Like, nah. And the reason I didn't like it was, I mean, I was good at volleyball and basketball and all these other sports, and I didn't want to add another one. And honestly, I thought they were hazardous. I thought they were dangerous. I didn't really see the fun in the event. And so I avoided them for good. Yeah, almost 2 years I avoided the hurdles. Yeah.
Did you grow to like them eventually or was it always?
I did. So the evolution was so strange because, you know, I was really good at them. So I would have been a world-class 100 meter sprinter as well. Yes. But not to the degree that I was like, you know, cream of the crop, like the 1% in the hurdles, like of a generation. That probably would have not happened. But the hurdles are very different in that it's all about your cadence. So how many steps you can take, how fast you can take those steps and how you can clear each hurdle, right? It's so technical that I was really good at that. So I had natural speed, but then technically I was just like a piston, like just up and down, up and down, up and down. So that was my gifting. That's why I was world class at it. And I think I eventually, when I first started doing the event, I did it because I was good at it, right? Like I could beat people, I was winning. It wasn't that hard in that way. I didn't really learn to love the hurdles until I was in university and had gotten a scholarship and very reluctantly took that scholarship, right? And when my mother, it's funny, and I wrote about this in the book, when my mother got the scholarship letter and saying that the scholarship was valued at $25,000 a year, she thought it was a bill. She thought they were telling her she had to pay that. And she was like, no, like this is how much sport was not in our lineage, not a conversation for us, not anything that we knew anything about, right? And eventually in university is really when I sunk my teeth into it. And I'm like, okay, this is something now. I love this. This is good. It's only because, again, I'd gotten beat at a very big race. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wasn't trying that hard. I was just gifted. And I'm like, what happens if I use my gift and I apply some pressure and some force and some dedication to this? Whoa. And that was the year before the World Championships in 2003 that I ended up winning. And that's when I saw that I was powerful, you know, and I truly could do this if I wanted it enough.
I think the winning obviously is is what inspires everybody to keep moving, right? It's that kind of like you get on that train, you get the medals and you start going, and you've got, you know, a Canadian world record, which still stands, and two world championships. And so there's the positives and the emphasis on the winning, but then there's the failures, as you spoke about, for example, the, you know, grade eight losing, like finally after a slew of wins and what that does to you. And then you chose to, you know, come back to it at some point. And then we have the 2004 Olympics in Athens and your fall and, you know, that experience for you, which is, you're on the world stage. It's a higher level of pressure, a higher level of failure to experience. And so how do you, you know, most people after grade eight just wouldn't have come back, right? Feeling that feeling of failure because there's so much tied into it emotionally. But now you're on the world stage and it's the Olympics and it's well, you've said not necessarily your dream come true, but something that is the next step on your journey. How do you overcome? How do you come back from that?
For sure. Oh, let's be clear. By the time I got to Athens, I wanted it. Like I had been an athlete. I was locked in for a few years now, at least like 3 years by then. I was like in it. Like this was my thing. So Athens was not like I just showed up and it's like, I'm talented. No, like I'm here, right? I want this. And yeah, to be the world champion and to get to hurdle one and then fall at hurdle one, you know, the race is 2.25 seconds old. Like that's the stat, right? And it's funny when you're a technician, right? You know, like 2.25 seconds, right? You could snap your finger, you could blink and snap again, that's the race. The race is 12 seconds long. And so when I fell at hurdle one, I could see the rest of the nine hurdles running. Like I could see this Olympic final unfold. I was literally watching this jumbotron. I'd fallen so violently and twisted in a way that I could see the biggest jumbotron in this Greek Olympic stadium that I saw the last 10 seconds of the race. Cruelest thing ever, right? But I couldn't look away. And I think when you experience, I think we all experience failure. That's failure on a global level, like cover of magazines and newspaper articles like around the globe. You don't even have to be Canadian to know that this is like a devastating story, right? And for me, I think one of the difficulties in that race is I fell so out of control that the athlete to my right, who was Russian, Irina Shevchenko, I bowled her out of her race. So she completely was knocked out of the race by me. So not only do you have your own mess up, right? You're the author of your own failure. You have now cost somebody else their dream. And I know what that dream means. I know what it means to fight so hard to even be at an Olympic final. And here I am having cost another woman her dream. So that is the weight of everything that I was holding on to, right? And I think, how do you get over that? I think there's a lot of pity parties, quite frankly, a lot of feeling sorry for yourself initially. But I had such a strong sense of who I was based on my mother, right? And I remember when someone, they couldn't console me in the belly of that stadium. They could not find a way. Because how do you put, you know, Humpty Dumpty together again after that? The millions of pieces of me are all across the track scattered. There's no way. And the only thing they could do was call my mother. Of course, it's back in 04, so they have this big clunky like satellite phone, right? And they're calling her up and it's staticky. And the first thing my mother says, and I'm like, girl, where did you get this from? She says, P, dry your eyes, hold your head up high. You are the gold. And that was just like someone had given me some air, just given me, and anyone that's been through anything traumatic, you know that you don't necessarily, you're not looking for it to be over. You know you're in it. You know you're feeling this crap, whether it's divorce or death or some grieving situation, you know it's gonna take time. But really all you want is some relief and a little bit of strength to just take your next breath or your next step. And if you can keep doing that. And literally what my mom gave me in that moment was just a little bit of strength, a little bit of oxygen so I can be like, okay, you know, and take the edge off my pain. And honestly, for me, it just took coming back to my sport every day and fighting the demons of the doubt and the fear again, to just be able to come back. And there are times I would show up at the track and be at a race and I'm literally at maybe 25% power. Like there's no sign of this world champion. There's no sign of this national record holder. There's no sign of any of that. But I said, if I just show up every day to this race, every start line, face every single hurdle, I will be at 100% one day. I don't care if it takes me 10 years. I don't care if it takes me 100 years. Mm-hmm. But again, like I said earlier, every storm runs out of rain. All I had to do was outlast the storm. I don't know how long the storm is going to be here. My God, I hope it's not forever, but it can't be forever. And so that's what I would hold on to. And literally it was just me promising myself that I would just show up, whatever the percentage was.
Julie and I were talking before this podcast, before we sat down with you, just about your voice and how powerful your voice is. And you've turned it into a career in broadcasting and speaking, but it's almost like through your athletics and your athletic training, power and strength has been just, you know, woven into you so deeply. And does that make sense to you? And how has sport shaped you and the person you are today? How has it?
Thank you to both of you for saying that. I really do appreciate it. Cause I think what, like as women, I feel like we are so powerful, we are so strong. And I think sometimes it takes us a long time to mine what that strength is and what that voice is, mm-hmm. right? And I do feel like sport has helped me for sure. But I truly know that, you know, when you've lived in a woman's shelter with your mother, you know, as a, God, how old was I? 6, maybe 7. I just maybe turned 7. You know, as a 7-year-old, I didn't know that that was a place we should have been and why. I liked it there. Suddenly mom is laughing and, you know, I'm like, mom has a big old laugh. Like I remember noticing that because they tease her and stuff because mom has big legs and they'd be like, there's this Mary Brown's Fried Chicken had a slogan. They were down the street and their slogan was, Mary Brown's has the best legs in town. And all the other women would tease her like, no, Mary Brown does not. Kathy does, right? And she had these big, powerful thighs. And, you know, I remember them laughing about that when they would clean the kitchen and all those things, right? And I think that strength and that power really comes from seeing a woman so beat down and broken down by life and people and circumstances. And despite that being her reality, she finds a reason to press on. She finds a reason to continue and to find her voice, right? And honestly, I will say this. How dare I, having been a witness to my mother's struggles, not be great? Mm. And great for me doesn't have to be this big public, people know my name, but I mean, do something with my life, right? Like if anything, I owed that woman that. And I don't know if it was a psychic knowing. I don't know if it was just having just witnessed it so much and that I was just so determined. I also know that she passed it on to me, but it was like, I would have been making a mockery, right, of seeing all the things my mother went through, like living in the small little room because she fled my dad, you know, the one summer that she found the strength to flee my dad. And the case is women who flee their abusers, it takes more than one time, which was the case with my mother, but she tried. So how dare I live in this one little small bedroom on a couch with my mother and my sister who's just left my dad and see her, you know, paying this rent and has no money to really do much of it. And not go on and do something with that struggle. To me, it would have been a shame. Mm. So thank you for saying that you see the strength and you see the power, because I truly think my whole life, I've wanted my mother to see herself in me. And I will say this, and there's times growing up, my mother would see me achieving and accomplishing things. And especially academically, right? Because I was very good academically, you know, honor roll student in university and, you know, great grades in elementary school and high school. And she would always say, well, you get it from your dad. You get it from your dad. My mother could never, because she had no education herself. She finally went on to get her grade 12 when she was in her, you know, early 40s. But she would always say to me, I'd bring home a report card or bring home something as proof. Oh, you get it from your dad. You get it from your dad. And I'm like, no, mom, I'm pleading with her. No, mom, I got it from you. Because I want her to take the credit. Mm-hmm. Because where is this man? He's nowhere to be found, but who's here? You. And my mother would never take, even to this day, with the book doing so well, she's proud, yes. But I know there's a part of her that thinks, well, I don't have a university education. I don't have a college education. And, you know, I went back and got my grade 12 later in life, yes. But, you know, Padit, you know, that was on your dad's side. But do you see how still to this day, all that, her being beaten down by people in life, is still entrenched in her in some way. Mm-hmm. And so that's why this power and this voice that I have to use it, if anything, to make this woman know all that we are doing, mother, is because of you. And you can take credit in that, right? You don't have to feel any sense of like, you are not good enough. You are not worthy, and nothing great and good could truly fully come from you. I think I'm always constantly in a state of wanting to show my mother that you are worthy and you are enough.
That's 100% wow. from her.
I hope that she does see that this book, maybe through the book, she will see all that she has given you. You know, it'll start to slowly sink in, because, you know, even though you say you had to do something with yourself and with your voice, it doesn't necessarily mean you had to do great things. You have done great things. And not only being, you know, a world champion hurdler, Olympic hurdler, you have this kinesiology degree that you got in 2004 as well. You went on and got your journalism in 2013 to use your voice, right? To continue to use your voice. And then, you know, your courses in writing as well. And so tell us about that transition from this, you know, renowned athlete into a different, completely different career, and what that was like for you.
Yeah, you know, it's, I feel fortunate that I knew what I wanted to do before I retired. Because I think a lot of the struggles, you know, imagine dedicating your whole entire life, your young life especially, to like one thing. And that one thing gives you so much praise, I guess, is a way to say it, right? And then suddenly you retire and it's like, oh, nobody wants my autograph. Okay, where's all that noise? Where's all the clapping? Where's the, Fernita, you're so great for running, right? Like that stops completely. But I knew what I wanted to do next, which was fortunate. So I didn't have to search. And I didn't have to like try and figure out who I am. What is my identity after running? Like I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster, but here's how I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster, completely by fluke, which is why when you were talking about the sliding doors, Julie, it's like this sliding door. So in 08, of course, Athens, we know I fell. In 08, I was going to go back to, you know, and right that wrong and be great. And the 07 year leading into the Olympics was an amazing year. Like I'm on the world podium again at world championships, the fastest, you know, world championship race in history. I got a silver medal in that. So I'm going into Beijing Olympics in 08 to like make up for 04. I get injured and I can't go there. But then because I can't go to Beijing to race, which is a very devastating thing. Again, imagine 04 and then 08 again, another letdown, massive disappointment. But CBC calls and they asked my agent if I wanted to come and broadcast in Beijing. And my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, you know, I was like, I don't want to do this. Like, no, like I'm this is horrible. Like, why would I go and call a race that I should be in? Like, no. And he's the one who really said like, look, I know this is going to be hard. I get it. If you want to say no, but you like sitting here and feeling sorry for yourself is probably not the best thing. Imagine you could see the Olympics in a brand new way. And you actually have a lot of stuff to say, because more than any broadcaster or reporter there, you've actually lived this thing. You can talk about the mix zone. You can talk about getting in the blocks. You can talk about walking through, people, you know, the crowd and the stands, like you can talk about that. If I could put my feelings aside, that was the hard part though, putting my feelings aside. So when he said that to me, I was like, you know what? He's right. I will have the best view than anybody else. So I went to Beijing. I loved those 10 days of broadcasting. Had no idea what I was doing, okay? But I loved it. And then when I left there after those 10 days, I thought, oh, Pradeet, I think this is the thing. I think this, and I wouldn't retire for another 5 years, right? Which is a really long time, you know, in the lifespan of a hurdler. So I had another 5 years. But because I knew what I wanted to do, when I came out, I hit that ground running. And so the transition wasn't hard. Now I went to Seneca to get a broadcast degree, and it was because I wanted people to take me seriously. And it was because I didn't want to just be a track analyst, right? I wanted to cover everything. And this summer, literally, I am now going to have my dream job at the Olympics. I will be with CBC hosting a show, Tokyo Today. And I'm like, I'm scared crapless. Can I say that? But I'm excited. Like, this is what I've worked to do. And I'm finally getting to do it. So the transition for me, I will say, has not been hard, because I knew, but it's been one of just trying to reinvent myself and then letting go of like, you're not the Olympian, or you are the Olympian, but you're not the athlete anymore, and being peace with this different identity.
Amazing. Congratulations. That's huge. Yeah. Tell us about All-Around Champion as well. I think that's going into season two, and it sounds like a great show.
Yeah. So yeah, All-Around Champion. Oh yeah. So in Canada, and I'll just say this, yeah, in Canada, season two, but in the States, they're already aired season three and four in the bank. So I'll start that way. So essentially, Around Champion is like 10 athletes, five Canadian, five American from all across, basically all across North America, all across different sports. And every week they compete in a different sport, but the person whose sport it is, they become the coach. And then we bring in like a superstar from that world. It could be tennis, skating, could be hockey. You know, they come in and they coach alongside the athlete, but they only have 3 days to learn this sport and then compete. So it goes really fast. I'm so proud of it going into, you know, its fourth season, because it just shows you the power that sport has. These athletes have to learn that you're not necessarily the best in other things. They have to learn really tough lessons about losing, right? And falling short. And really, honestly, like how to like, every sport takes like a different attitude or a different kind of feel. Like the way you might go into a fencing competition is very different than you going to like a wakeboard or a surfing competition, right? So they really are learning these lessons. And it's selfish for me too, because I'm like living my path through them. Like I get to be like this tween athlete once again, and like going through the excitement of learning, you know, these things. And, you know, I'm really proud that I was chosen and asked to be the one to guide 40 athletes now, my goodness, through, you know, 10 weeks of being away from home, because they're away from home. They live together and they don't see their families for almost 3 months.
Wow, that's incredible. And when, like you said, it takes you back to, you know, being your own experience. And but all that goes into being an athlete, right? Like I think that for a lot of us, like we get to sit back and watch the experience that you guys are having, but without really acknowledging or knowing all of the work that goes into the hours of training, the mental, you know, capacity that you have to have. And so I'm curious about that when you first started, like, you know, you putting yourself in the shoes of these young athletes that you're kind of coaching and being a part of as well. And what that was like for you. And if you feel like you missed out on anything, right? Like if you feel like there was like, did you go to prom and did you, you know, get to experience like, you know, college parties and things like that? Like, what was that like for you?
You know, that is the thing about being an athlete, because you dedicate your life to one thing and you do see your friends moving on. You see your friends living their lives and doing their things, and you kind of feel, you know, like that fear of missing out is real, to be honest. With our athletes, what I do say to them though, and I say this to every cast that comes through, is for them to really sink, you know, deeply into these moments. Right? Like enjoy this moment as an athlete, enjoy your time as an athlete, because you don't get it back. Now, do I miss hurdling? Not really, right? But what I do miss is that pursuit, that journey, that kind of superpower of like being the best. I miss that, but I'll never get that back. Like I'm 40 years old, no one's jumping any hurdles today. But like, you know, 20 and 25 and 30, I miss that. And so what I try to remind them of, you know, like it goes really, really quickly. And when you're 15 and 16, sometimes you feel invincible. You feel like, oh, I'll have this time forever. You really won't. And, you know, one of the journeys that I'm on now, and one of the things, you know, I kind of wrestle with is, you know, by virtue of being an athlete, I put motherhood off until the last possible moment. I do have friends who had children and started their families while they were still actively competing. I knew that wasn't for me. I was too selfish and I didn't want to have to share my time with a screaming, crying, beautiful baby. Was not interested. But I waited till I was 38. Now, when I decided, my husband and I decided to try at 38, well, we couldn't conceive, right? It didn't happen quickly and easily for us to the point that we needed intervention. And so even now I'm wondering like, did I leave it too long? Like now Nova's like 2 years old. I'm turning 41 this summer. And it's like, oh God, it's tiring to run after this baby. You know, if I had run when I was 30, maybe it would have been easier. But I do know that that's just the journey that I took. But it is something that women in sport especially have to contend with, that men in sport don't have to. Mm. And it is something that I do want to explore, like maybe in a second book or, you know, something like that, about the things that women really have to give up, you know, for this journey of motherhood, and that how when you get to motherhood, it's not this, you know, it's a beautiful thing, yes, but it's not everything that we sometimes paint it to be. Like, I want to complain some days. Some days I feel bad about complaining.
Oh yeah, tell us about that. We've got 7 kids between the two of us, and it's nice to hear, like, you know, a national Olympic athlete saying how tiring motherhood is. You know, it's exhausting. I want to make sure we touch on your experience being a Black athlete and a Black woman in Canada. And you mentioned earlier the reckoning, right, with your father, and how a reckoning for things, bad things being done, needs to happen. And, you know, during Black Lives Matter, you were quite, you took to Twitter and you expressed how you felt about what was happening and what changes needed to happen in sport and elsewhere. And so where are you now with the reckoning that needs to happen with regards to race, racism in Canada?
Yeah, you know what, I think I was so happy that I found my voice last year. And I do think, like, Gen Z, like, you have to follow that generation, that younger generation. They're not, this inequality stuff, this racism, like, this generation, you know, behind us, they're not with it. Like, they're not taking it. And it was interesting because I was asked, like, as an athlete, would you have been okay speaking about these things, you know, as vividly and as honestly as you are now? And I had to be honest. No, I would have kept my mouth shut. Sponsors are involved, you know, your popularity, all those things. But the climate is very different now, and I'm grateful for that, right? I will say that I do believe that as a society and as a country, the reckoning is only just beginning. And how could any of us not feel something when you hear about 215 bodies of Indigenous children being dug up from a residential school in BC, in Kamloops? Now, I think as Canadians, sometimes we take comfort in thinking, well, this happened in the US, or this happened, you know, overseas, this happened over there, or this happened, you know, 400 years ago. We take comfort in that because we think we're different. But the truth is, we are still living this today. And the mother that I am was like, oh no, To have your child taken in the middle of the night and you never, ever see them again. That's something that we have to confront. That's something that each and every one of us who has a platform has to say something about it so that change can happen. I am hopeful that this change is, it's not too difficult, meaning it's possible. Like, you know, your children can live and inherit a future that maybe we didn't. Right? Where the conversation about gender equality, racial equality, right, is something that they really don't have to fight or heavy lift because it is there. But unless those of us who have the platform say something, I don't think it will ever change. I don't want Nova to ever, you know, have to feel what I felt as, you know, a lone Black child in my elementary school and having, you know, the word, the N-word, you know, hurled at me. I don't want that to be her reality. Well, how can that not be her reality? I have to say something. I have to do what I can. I think people get, you know, people get mixed up because they're like, well, what do I do? And what do I say? And how can I possibly do anything? And I do feel like, one, having the conversation like we are now is what we have to do. Mm-hmm. And to pretend that you can't have the conversation is a you know, disservice to you and a disservice to your children. If an Indigenous woman has to have a conversation with her child about, you know, bodies being dug up from the earth and why, then every single one of us are able to have that same conversation with ourselves and with our own children, right? And educate them and make our boys allies, right? Make our white children allies. We can do that, right? And my friend was asking me last year, like, what can I do? Right. And, you know, he's a white guy and, you know, we talk on Twitter all the time. And, you know, I said, what do the books look like? He has twins and they're darling. And they're like, what do the books look like on your daughter's bookshelves? He's like, they're not diverse. They only look like our kids. I'm like, then you know what to do. And, you know, he asked me for some titles and I gave him some titles. Now that can seem like a small thing, right? But it really isn't a small thing. The reason it isn't a small thing is because now his little girls, when they're reading books, the story in this book about this Black character or this Indian character is no different than my fear or my excitements as a child. And then now you've empowered your two daughters as they now go through life, right? the plights and the identities of the people that maybe don't look like them, now they can actually identify with maybe their grievances or their issues or their problems. The problem happens when you don't know what's happening to somebody else in their culture, in their skin, in their shoes. Well, how could you take up the cause of, you know, the indigenous community if you've never had to embrace that cause? If you don't even understand or know what that cause is, well, it doesn't matter to me. I don't care. I don't know. Right? That's what blinders do. Let's all take off the blinders. Right? And I think really that's where it starts. If we can just do the tiniest things in our power, those things just multiply and multiply until you look around. It's like, wow, everyone swept their front door. The whole damn house is clean. The whole world is clean. Do you know what I mean?
I love that, you know, idea that you're saying that, you know, we're trying to teach empathy to our children, but how can you if you don't even know what their experience is? So that is a beautiful thing. And I'm so happy that you have found your voice in on this now, but also that you have such a strong voice, because that's what the Afterglow is really. It's about women finding their voice and then being able to use it to really find their truest selves, to sort of save themselves and save the world in essence. But you know, it's your next act. It's when you did, you know, stop following the rules of what you were supposed to do and told what to do. And then you went and did what you wanted to do. And so, you know, you've already had multiple acts. You said that you're in your second act already, but what's your afterglow? What is next for you?
Oh, all the things. Oh, I want everything. I want everything that life has to give me. Goodness. So I always tend to go to career when people ask me this question, like, what is next? So obviously I want to write more books. Like, I'm not a one-time book writer. I feel like I'm a nonfiction writer. So I want that. I want to adapt My Mother's Daughter into something for television or film. Mm. You know, I see it being a deep dive, you know, possibly as a documentary into like family or identity or home. What is home for a woman? What is home for a family? What does that look like? Maybe more babies. You never know, right? Like, you guys said you have 7 between you?
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's not recommended. It's a lot.
I have 1, 7. Wow, I'm going to call you for some notes later on.
Yeah.
And so hopefully that. And I think just, you know, my husband and I have been married for 4 years. We just celebrated our 4-year anniversary. And I think one of the things that we tend to do is focus on our child and focus on our career. We're really at the place where, like, let's strengthen us. Right. Mm. So we really want to strengthen us. And I do feel like I'm so driven career-wise that I'm like, no, I'm going to calm down for a little bit and just sow into my family more consciously, and like say no to work when as much as I can. But I think that's what's next. Like more afterglowing is what's next, I think.
Yeah. As you know, you're just recently crossed the 40 landmark and you're getting bolder and braver, it sounds like. So what would you say to women, which is our audience, who are, you know, in their 40s, 50s, who might be thinking it's too late for me, this ship has sailed. What advice would you have for them?
You can always reinvent yourself. I turned 40 last August. And again, I'm going to be, like I said, 41 this August. I think I hit that date and suddenly I was like, oh, don't F with me, world. Don't F with me, anybody. Like, I know who I am and I don't care. I think to any woman who's maybe unsure of herself or, you know, not exactly where she wants to be, I would say, look at my mother's playbook, right? My mother doesn't follow, and if you, at all, you know, any kind of feminist, you know, traditional playbook. She has completely lived her life the way that she wants to live it, unapologetically. And I think she has shown me that you can steer your life, you know, into any new horizon, and you can pivot. Right? And you can pause and stop and be like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to do something else. But I will say the biggest thing that I've learned in turning 40 during a pandemic is, for a long time, I was so conscious about being perfect, right? Like not dropping any balls, right? So Perdita can't be late. Oh, this assignment is due. Oh, you said you do this. It has to look like this. And I worked myself so hard into a grind last year that I was definitely going towards burnout. The point where it's like, oh, I'm having these headaches. What are these headaches? I'm getting a CT scan. Like, it was a scary place to be. Suddenly my friend's like, I think you're burning out. I was like, me? Burning out? No, like, no, there's no such thing. Like, I don't stop when the work is done, you know, or I don't stop when I'm tired. I stop when the work is done, which is very different. But I will say the lesson is this, women, okay? we are all juggling multiple balls. And I think, as you know, in our households especially, right, the lion's share of the work is really on us, right? Like, it is. You were like the, you know, the, what do you call it, like the director in chief or whatever, like we're the CEOs. And I think we're so scared about dropping any ball. Mm-hmm. And we will drop other balls. Sorry, we will drop our health just so we don't drop another ball, right? And I've learned this year, I will always drop a rubber ball, meaning I will drop a call, I will drop a meeting, I will drop a friendship, right? Because those glass balls, my health, my happiness, my child's well-being and my relationship are glass balls I am not willing to drop. Because if you drop a glass ball, it shatters. If you drop a rubber ball, it can bounce back and you can repair it. Now, I'm not promoting be a flaky friend, be unreliable. I'm not saying any of that, right? But what I'm saying is sometimes we have too many things in the air and we are so afraid of letting somebody else down that we sacrifice ourselves. How many times have you maybe made an obligation to do something and suddenly life has gone a different avenue that week or that weekend and you can't do it and you feel so bad about making the call, whatever? Maybe it's your reputation. Maybe you think you're not going to get that promotion. Listen, now, Perdita, I drop that ball. But I make up for it, right? If I can't make something, I find a replacement or I tell you how it's going to go another way and I make it up. But the point is, I used to sacrifice my own well-being and my own health and work myself to the bone. And then what good are we? We're good to nobody. And I'll end with this saying that I just heard on the weekend. It was by Iyanla Van Zandt and I loved it. Mm-hmm. So she says, you know, her cup runneth over. So if you can think about a cup running over, like with water or whatever, right? And everything in that cup is for you. Everything that's full to the brim is for you. But guess what? Everything that runs over is for everybody else. That's what you give everybody else, what's left. Fill yourself up first so that you can give everybody else what you have left, right? And I love that. And that's what I'm living by now.
So many incredible lessons in this podcast. Like, I just want to write them all down. I want to shout them out. And I know that so many women out there are going to learn so much. And you know, the interesting thing is that we think about, you know, athletes and professional, you know, celebrities and stuff as really untouchable and unhuman. And you have such a human experience that you're sharing with the world. And so we're so grateful that you have written this book, that you are now, you know, out there for the world to actually, you know, kind of have a little bit of a piece of and share. So thank you so much. We're so grateful for having you.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks, Julie. This was a treat. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Perdita. I'll just add, that's the end of the recording, but I'll just add, you may not be able to strive towards physical excellence anymore. I know what that's like when you're past 40, but you're definitely striving for personal excellence in every way. That really shines through. So
I'm trying. Thank you for this.
I can't even imagine moving right now during this whole COVID upheaval, and it would be like the worst thing in the world to have to uproot your family and try to find a home or sell your home in this market. Actually, sellers might have a better deal, but then where do you go? I just want to mention that I have always had such an incredible experience with Mark Richards and the Richards Group, and I love this guy because he, you know, took his name off of the Richards Group and made it about the family and the whole entire group. So they are stand-up people. They are a stand-up company. Find them at therichardsgroup.ca for all of your moving needs.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Afterglow. Yet another courageous Canadian sharing her vision.
Do us a favor and lift a sister up by sharing this podcast with others who want to find their afterglow. And let us know, what do you want to hear about? Who do you want to hear from? And what is your afterglow? Slide on into our DMs at The Afterglow Podcast Official and leave us a message.
Did you love this podcast? Be sure to like and rate us on Spotify and iTunes and wherever you tune in. Until next time.